Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. Today's episode is the first episode of a new season of Patron Deities. We have moved on from our previous season on Japanese mythology, and we're going to be talking about the myths and legends of ancient Egypt. So in today's episode, we're going to start with a brief overview of ancient Egyptian culture and ancient Egyptian religion, and I do mean very brief, and then we're going to talk about the first god in this section, the sun god Ra. So dealing with ancient Egyptian religion in a gaming context is a little different from some of the other ones that we've talked about. You know, I think everyone knows what ancient Egyptian religion looks and feels like in a kind of pop cultural stereotypical sense, right? Animal-headed gods, mummies, probably the distant keening of some kind of reed pipe. Egypt possesses a particular fascination for modern audiences, but not just for modern audiences. It's kind of been the example of a quote-unquote mysterious ancient civilization, really from the classical period to the modern day, right? Like Plato justifies kind of fables by saying that they were learned in Egypt, and lots of other ancient Greek writers attribute kind of magic and things like that to Egypt. You know, a couple years ago, I went to the Monstrous Antiquities conference, and there was a talk by Katerina Minniti, and she was talking about the representation of ancient Egypt in video games, and one of the things that she pointed out was that there are games that are kind of like ostensibly historical, where Egyptian units still have kind of magical powers, and that this is consistent in some ways with classical understandings of Egyptian civilization. So this is one of those things that is like a stereotype, but it's an authentic ancient stereotype. And that view persisted, you know, into the Middle Ages and into the post-medieval period, and I think to some extent into the modern day. Christopher Lerick has written about this idea of two Egypts. There's the actual historical Egypt, and then there's the esoteric Egypt. And it's not that the esoteric Egypt isn't sort of discussed in a consistent way, but it just bears not very much resemblance to, you know, Egypt, the actual country full of actual people. It's like a symbol that exists in the minds of Europeans, and, you know, nothing you really understand about the history or the language or the culture of ancient Egypt will shift that. But even within a more grounded understanding of ancient Egyptian history and culture, I think that we still have a tendency to kind of see it in this romantic way. From things like the Corpus Hermeticum and Rosicrucianism, all the way through to, you know, mummy movies and Tomb Raider, it becomes hard for us to perceive the reality of ancient Egyptian religious practice through this veil of kind of occult sensationalism. Now, that might not necessarily be a bad thing. We are engaged in creating role-playing game campaigns, and, you know, occult sensationalism is a perfectly valid artistic, not to get too pretentious, but artistic choice for that purpose, as long as we don't let ourselves mistake that for reality. But at the same time, it can't hurt to look at some of the ways in which there's more to ancient Egyptian religion than we sort of expect from the stories that were told about it and the ways in which it's represented in art. So one of the first and most important things is that religion in ancient Egypt changes over time. You know, we're not always good at recognizing changes between historical periods when one of those periods isn't the present day, because we can understand a change against something that is all around us, so we have this thing to compare it to, but two different historical periods we sometimes struggle with. I'm sure I've talked before about the Attila the Hun TV movie. Jared Butler plays Attila the Hun, and there's this bit at the end where, you know, he's fighting the Romans, and the Romans are in, like, first century uniforms. You know, they've got the Lorica Segmentata, they've got the big kind of rectangular but curved shields. You know, they look like they're about to go chase an Asterix around Gaul. And that is wildly wrong for the Roman armies that would have fought Attila the Hun, right? I mean, we're talking about a gap of hundreds of years. It's as if at the beginning of Saving Private Ryan, all of the, you know, U.S. soldiers had stormed ashore with, like, muskets and tricorner hats. Like, it's that far out. We can understand that when we compare it to something that's within our own experience, but it's harder for us to do when we're talking about two historical periods. We tend to conflate them. Look at how something like Xena Warrior Princess treats Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar as if they were approximate contemporaries when they're as far apart as Benjamin Franklin and Barack Obama. This is a roundabout way of my saying that the history of Egyptian religion is a long one. You know, the civilization that we think of as ancient Egypt begins around the beginning of the first dynastic period, which is about 3100 BC, you know, give or take, very give or take. Egyptian dating is a whole thing of its own. And I don't know that much about it. Remember, like, although, you know, my background is as an archaeologist, Egyptology, you know, that's not an area that I've really paid that much attention to. And then, you know, we draw a dividing line around the beginning of the Ptolemaic period, which is in the 300s BC. So we're talking about, you know, 2800 years of history. The history of ancient Egyptian religion is longer than the entire history of Christianity. And again, you know, just to use a comparison that we might be familiar with. So if you can imagine the changes between, you know, modern Christianity and early Christianity, and then imagine a religion that doesn't have the kind of incentive that Christianity has to maintain fidelity to a single central text, which ancient Egyptian religion does not have, there is no force, there's nobody whose job it is to keep ancient Egyptian religion consistent with a particular set of beliefs or teachings. Why would there be? So ancient Egyptian religion in like the Old Kingdom and the New Kingdom can look very different from each other. And indeed they do, as we shall see. Also, this is a very regional religion. It's focused around particular temples and their particular cults. So the most important god in one city might not necessarily be the most important god in another city. And as the political fortunes of those cities rise and fall, we might see the religious fortunes of those gods rise and fall, a little bit like we saw with the Babylonian mythos. Now, one of the things that's nice about this section is that it actually does begin with a discussion. It's very brief, but it does mention the idea that ancient Egyptian religion changed a lot over time, and that it was not consistent from place to place either. You know, even though it doesn't really say any more than that, you know, good on them for putting in that little disclaimer. But there's an important concept that isn't discussed in this introduction, and that isn't present anywhere in this section, and I think that you can't look at ancient Egyptian religion without at least addressing. That is the concept of Ma'at. So Ma'at is, and I'm sorry if my pronunciation's wrong, you know, what do I know about ancient Egyptian? But Ma'at is the concept of kind of cosmic order or cosmic harmony, balance, it's often translated as. And I said it was cosmic, but it is also social. You know, if we're going to use D&D alignment concepts, this is a profoundly lawful religion concerned with maintaining and protecting the cosmic order. And as an ideal and a cosmic force, Ma'at is personified as a deity, but not one that's in this book. Now, in a way that makes sense, like, I don't know how much direct worship Ma'at as a deity received, but it's kind of a shame. That point about personification is important. As far as I'm aware, you know, the ancient Egyptians understood all the like people with animal heads and stuff as symbolic representations of divine concepts. They did not think that you would eventually get to the afterlife and there would be like a big man with a bird head, any more than like Christians literally believe that there's a big fellow with a white beard sitting on a cloud, right? That is an artistic representation of a theological concept. Now, because of this idea of harmony, and because of the kind of nature of Egyptian society, and especially the extent to which the Egyptian economy, and therefore kind of everybody's life, was dependent on the flooding of the Nile that made Egypt so agriculturally productive, a lot of Egyptian thinking about divine things is focused on the idea of like cyclical patterns of things that happen and recur over and over again. Changes of years, crowning and deaths of kings, and of course, the rising and setting of the sun. And when we talk about the sun, we have to talk about Ra. Now, Ra is listed here as the head of the pantheon, and like a lot of pantheons and deities and demigods, you know, obviously this is kind of like a contested slot, but if you absolutely had to, you know, if somebody gave you a list of every deity in Egyptian mythology and said, you know, you must choose a supreme deity or I'll be rude to this puppy. If you picked Ra, I don't think any Egyptologist would look at you and say, that's a weird choice. Ra is one of several deities that's been the supreme deity in Egyptian mythology. He's the god of the sun and the creator of life. His sort of cult center is in Heliopolis, Sun City. And, you know, he initially is kind of like the sort of the chief deity there. He is associated with kings and chief deity of the pantheon by like round about the 5th dynasty, which is about the 25th or 24th centuries BC. So we're several hundred years into the history of Old Kingdom or like early dynastic Egypt before we get Ra as like a recognized head of the pantheon, but he fits. At different times, he is combined with other gods. So, for example, you'll sometimes see a combination falcon and sun deity, and that's Ra Horakhti, Ra who is Horus of the two horizons. Or you'll see Atum Ra, and then later on in the New Kingdom period, Ra is kind of merged with the sort of god of divine power, the hidden power, Amun, and becomes Amun-Ra. And of course, Amun will later be identified with Zeus and create Zeus-Amun, which is why the curved shell is called an Ammonite. One of Ra's forms is a ram head, so Amun is associated with the image of a ram, and the shell is curved like a ram's horn, so it's an Ammonite. Zeus Ammon has horns. There you go. But so this was essentially a way to take the kind of new dominant sect of Amun and like legitimize it and build kind of, I guess, bridges with the older Ra cults by creating this hybrid deity, Amun-Ra. So the main myth of Ra is probably the journey across the sky, right? This is the sun. So every morning, Ra rises in the east. And on the morning barge, the barge of millions of years, he sails in his falcon-headed form up to noon. At noon, he gets into a different barge. And in his ram-headed form, he heads down to sunset. And during nighttime, he passes through Duat, the underworld, which is also the nighttime, where he merges or is connected to or is identified with Osiris, who we'll talk about later, but he's the god of the underworld in a way. It's complicated. So, and on his journey, there is someone who tries to stop him, and that is Apep, the great serpent, who you may be more familiar with by his Greek name, Apophis, in which role, I think he's a bad guy in the World of Darkness games. Apep represents a kind of cosmic chaos, right? To break the cycle of the sun rising and setting would be the ultimate blow at the cosmic order, the ultimate blow at the order of the natural world. And therefore, Apep has to be fought and protected. So there are all these other deities whose job is to, you know, guard and protect Ra on his journey across the sunlit sky. Ironically, one of the most important of those is Set, is a warrior god, but again, another deity whose role in Egyptian society will change a good deal. So Ra has some children, and I was surprised to see. So he has three daughters who are the eyes of Ra. He has Bastet, the cat goddess, who is in this section, along with Hathor and Sekhmet, who are inexplicably not in this section. There's no excuse for, I mean, for one thing, Hathor is a very important deity in Egyptian religion. And for another, Sekhmet is a great role-playing game deity. You know, if you were going to have a kind of fierce, judgmental paladin type whose job was to go around not just protecting the innocent or whatever, but punishing transgressors, right? What in 5th edition, what you call like the Oath of Vengeance, right? The evil paladin job. You know it's for evil paladins. Don't look at me like that. Go around punishing the guilty without fear or remorse. That's lawful evil, son. Anyway, I'm really surprised to find that Hathor and Sekhmet are not in this section. So we're definitely going to talk about them at the end of the season. We may wind up talking about a lot of people at the end of the season. Like in a lot of mythologies, Ra has a range of different forms. So he's often portrayed as a falcon-headed man. But sometimes he has a ram's head, right? So that's in his noon to sunset form. He's got the ram's head. Sometimes he's a scarab and so on, right? Sometimes he's just a falcon. Like, he has lots of different representations. Again, these all have their own different names, and they are all treated in some ways as different gods, but in a sense, they're all also aspects of Ra. The Deities and Demigods book lists Ra as neutral good, which is prize nonsense. This deity is as lawful gets. You know, he fulfills a cosmic order and endorses the political hierarchy of the state and keeps a watchful eye on humans lest they transgress against his laws. I don't know what you're thinking to call that neutral, but he fulfills a cosmic order that is ultimately beneficial to the living, which is why he's good. Keeps the sun shining, the crops growing, keeps away the dangers that otherwise would be everywhere in the land, not just at nighttime. I think, you know, in terms of having a middle of the road, good guy, even if not necessarily all that likable deity for your fantasy pantheon, a Ra is not a bad one. Because you can have some reservations about this guy, particularly the idea that Ra, you know, as the ruler of the gods, thus also like endorses and is connected to the king. Now, people will tell you that pharaohs, the word pharaoh is awkward. I feel like I've talked about this before. A lot of Egyptologists will say king rather than pharaoh, or will refer to rulers as pharaohs only when they're like in certain contexts. I don't fully understand why that is, but I think maybe there's a drive to kind of like not exotify this culture. So like when I'm talking about the king of France, I don't call him the roi, you know, I just call him the king, which is the English word for his job title. And same for the pharaoh. Pharaoh is just one of the many titles of the king, per a great house. But, you know, there's no reason not to just use the English word king. People will tell you that they were considered to be gods, and that is true in a sense, but I think that the relationship is actually a little bit more complex than that. They're divine and they're not divine. They're kind of mediators between the human and divine worlds, and they become fully divine, my understanding is, when they die. So they kind of have one foot in the spiritual world and one foot in the physical world, and people understand that they are, you know, people don't think that the pharaoh can't make bad decisions because he's partly divine. Like, it's self-evident that some pharaohs are idiots. See, I've been doing it all just now, but it's evident that some kings are idiots. But the impression I get is that this status as a semi-divine being, or perhaps wholly divine, gives the king a ritual position and spiritual responsibilities rather than necessarily endowing him with any perfection. There's a bit, I love this quote, and I used it to describe a character I once played, but there's a bit in some discussion of the Red Emperor in Glorantha in one of the books. And it's something, these are not the exact words, but someone says something like, if he were not Moon Sun, he would be nothing but a lazy drunk, but he is Moon Sun. And that means he's the greatest lazy drunk in the empire. And I don't think that's exactly right, but I do think that that attitude of understanding that, you know, like in official communication, of course, you have to flatter the king. But I don't think anyone actually thinks the king is some kind of supernatural being in the role in which they interact with him, if that makes sense. He has a divine aspect, but also there's the guy who's like setting tax policy or whatever, and that's his mortal aspect. And, you know, the idea of legitimizing divine rulers, I think, is definitely one that players' modern sensibilities will tend to rebel against. And I think that you can kind of approach it in two ways. One, I mean, and this is sort of what I would normally do, and that is to portray the king as, you know, as a fraud or a bungler, or, you know, the as long as he is fulfilling the correct ritual cycles, then it doesn't really matter whether he's any good at running the kingdom, because the gods aren't really concerned about, you know, foreign policy or whatever. They're concerned about the maintenance of the ritual cycle. All that other stuff is kind of below the level of abstraction to them, as long as the, you know, the correct buttons on their interface are being pushed. But if you want to run a campaign in which the players like approve of the gods and like them, then the other thing to do, I think, is make your king a flawed and vulnerable character, someone who has these divine responsibilities and wants to do the right thing, but perhaps, you know, has concerns about his own abilities or whatever, right? It just, you can say, well, look, this is a role that society has placed on this person. It's real, but that doesn't mean that it's not challenging for him. And I think, you know, I think if you, I mean, assuming you have the kind of game where the PCs are in contact with the king at all, right? This may be completely moot, but I think that that's the kind of positive spin without taking away too much player agency. The idea that that divine role creates obligations, not necessarily powers. The maintenance of the cosmic order is predicated on the maintenance of a ritual order, and kind of maintaining ritual and maintaining prayer is sort of the original, like in many ways, the responsibility of the state, but also people have all these personal interactions with the gods. Now, what I've read is that that's like not as much a feature of the evidence from earlier eras of Egyptian society, but the idea of a personal relationship with the gods kind of developed over its history. I don't know necessarily enough to say, but that is what I have read. And I think you need to include that ritual cycle in your game, right? If you want to give your game an ancient Egyptian feel, whether you're running an ancient Egyptian game or not, if you want to have that feel to it, there needs to be that ritual cycle. And that ritual cycle needs to be tied to the idea that this is kind of how stable nature continues, right? This is a society that has a perilous relationship with nature. It lives in effectively like a very extended oasis, right? Like this area that is distinctly different from the inhospitable landscape around it. You know, there's no greater danger than a breakdown of the regular cycles of inundation that feed the kingdom and also provide the main like export crop. So you have to set games against that constant backdrop of ritual and ceremony, and I think that then you can build up the idea of how shocking and frightening it is when those cycles break down, right? One morning the sun didn't come up is a pretty great premise for a scenario. Now, maybe, you know, maybe not for a first level scenario, but in the same way we have, you know, there's a, that cyclical idea extends through all levels of society. So whether it's just like one household failing to complete their ritual obligations or the king failing to complete his ritual obligations, the scale of the damage is different, certainly, but I think the underlying idea is the same. Okay, that's about all the time we have to talk about ancient Egyptian religion today. In our next episode, we're going to be talking about a couple more deities from the pantheon. We're going to be talking about Anhur, a god of war, one of many. We're going to be talking about Anubis, the god of the dead, and we're going to be talking about the aforementioned Apep, great serpent, god of chaos. And if we have time, we might talk about Apshai. All of that next time on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.